what I want to talk about for a little bit deals with history and time, a kind of larger concept. And you don't have to take notes if you don't want to, although Eric wants to take notes. Habit?
He's taking them for me.
I got a graduation card when I finished, and it showed all these people sitting at graduation in their caps and gowns, you know, and there's one in the back furiously scribbling away like this, and you open it up inside, and it says, psst, you can stop taking notes now, you know. So you really don't have to take notes, Eric, but whatever you'd like to do. Anyway, I'll talk for a while, and after a while you want to pursue this subject, that's fine, or if something else strikes your fancy, we can go in that direction a little bit too. As Dave said, there are other things happening as well, and I don't mean to monopolize all the time. I have to haul my watch out here and watch the time too, or I'll go on for Ewigkeit. Fireside chats, you know, are supposed to be meant to make people comfortable and to relaxed, and also you have to do this right and wear sweaters. Dr. Hummel reminded me Jimmy Carter sat in a cardigan next to the fireplace to make us all feel warm and cozy while we were turning down the thermostats, and he also told me I should get a dog in the meantime, Fallow, little Fallow. Do you know FDR's dog? You don't bring it along. I hope, you know, that you're not sufficiently cowed by this topic. I called it Latter-day Idols, subtitled History and Time, which sounds a bit foreboding, but it's really not, I don't think. I think we can fish enough out of here to maybe spark a little bit of discussion as we go along. We shall see, you know, inspire you to greater intellectual heights and rapture. Not that kind of rapture. In 90 minutes, that's right. It's in a twinkling of an eye, Eric. First my turn to talk, and then yours a little bit later here. We know, you know, that we have a tendency, in fact a certainty, to self-destruct. It's an unfortunate and dismal pattern that's been around since Genesis 3, and it's really only by theological judgment that we really realize this in ourselves. And perhaps more importantly, by theological judgment, we see the larger nature of the pattern, the nature of our situation. Now, in our circles, we quite readily admit that. We admit our failures, that is to say. We confess them regularly, maybe all too routinely. In corporate and in private worship, we have them staring us in the face every time we seem to turn around. But we live in a world and are not unaffected by the world, so that I think in some respects we may tailor our vocabulary or skewer our Christian outlook and color the understanding of our dilemma. At least I think we use language. At least I know I use language all the time, which really confesses a different outlook. I don't think I mean that intentionally. At least I hope I don't mean that intentionally. I think it's just sort of a matter of speech. We sort of fall into that. But I want to take a look at some of these notions over the next few moments and see, you know, if maybe we are guilty of a little bit of idolatry. We profess worship in the true God, and yet I fear we occasionally make ourselves latter-day idols. There are a number of ways to approach the matter of idolatry, a number we could identify, but this evening I want to focus on the business of history, which may seem a bit suicidal when one teaches that. Set that up and call that an idol, but I think it's still there nonetheless. History and time can become an idol in a very subtle way. It can foster patterns in thinking, in speaking, in action, which really run counter to the Christian faith. And I want to take time for a closer look at that. It's fashionable today to bemoan the state of the world. Things are always going badly, you know. It's getting worse. The world, pardon the expression, is going to hell in a handcart. It comes to mind because we just, in one of the classes, looked at Sebastian Brandt's book, The Ship of Fools. Remember that? And there was the fools actually going in a handcart on the way down to destruction. Wonder if that's the origin of the phrase. But the ancients were doomsayers as well. They bemoaned their culture. You get to the Renaissance and you have plenty of people bemoaning the state of humanity and history. There are these great odes to man and the dignity of man. Pico talks about his oration on the dignity to man. Man, he says, is no fixed planet, but can make of himself what he wants. Yet on the other side, you can find just as many. In fact, one author I've read suggests there are twice as many treatises on the misery of man. I have a whole little list here I could read you, but the titles are basically always the same. Dialogue on the Human Condition, which is negative, as the title goes on to say. On the Blessedness, on the Great Misery, a dialogue. On the Misery of the Human Condition, on the Misery of the Human Condition. On the Vanity and the Misery of Human Life, so forth and so on. Over and over again. There is no doubt a dark underside to the Renaissance. And when people lose their sense of values, they struggle to find some other value, or they live without. There are very bizarre things that happen during the Renaissance. In the artwork, one man, Hieronymus Bosch, an artist, painted a picture known as the Wandering Fool. There's a man who's careening off down a path through life with danger at every turn, and yet he's almost oblivious to it. He's so foolish, he has no idea what's happening, and he doesn't see how life is really ordered. He's just sort of going like a pinball, bouncing around through life. Or Peter Bruegel is another artist who has, he's got a number of things, peasant life, that you've probably seen somewhere along the line. Bruegel has a thing called The Blind Leading the Blind. One man hanging on for dear life because he's blind to another, not realizing that the first man is blind as well, and they're both about to plunge off down into the ditch at the side of the road. They've lost their sense of direction. Now that's art, you know, but then art's supposed to imitate life. In real life, there was a city in Italy which at its public meeting square had on a large wall painted a huge picture of the three living meeting the three dead, gathering at a public place, three normal people carrying on a conversation, sort of being greeted by three rotting corpses. You know, bizarre nature of life. Outside Paris in the 16th century, there was a place that was used for public executions. People hung from trees and the bodies left there to rot and decay. And the Parisians used to come out on Sunday and have picnics there amid these things. You know, you wonder, where are the values again? But I don't mean to get off on the misery of Renaissance. You could pick it up in any age. The Enlightenment has the great deists with their clean, clear systems of thought. It's also the age of Rosicrucianism. It's the time of the Masonic organizations rising up. You know, talk about bizarre and mysterious. In our own age, in the 19th century, people exuded a confidence, thinking that they had gone beyond the barbarous folk of the past, only to find themselves quite shaken when nations and peoples supposedly beyond barbarianism dug in for 4 years of trench warfare and spent weeks, sometimes months, gaining a few hundred yards of territory from here to there, behind now tanks instead of cavalry, beneath clouds of mustard gas. And the world in its euphoria after the war suddenly then is plunged into Great Depression, the worst it's ever had, which we get out of, in part, how much is still debated, but in part by another war. You know, it's a very dismal situation. Today, Europe boasts it's gone 40 years without a war, the longest time Europe's ever been without armed conflict. You know, it's incredible to think. People respond to this kind of a life in different ways. Some would accent the positive, if they can find the positive, namely, we've learned, we're improving. Yes, we still have troubles, but we handle them better than ever before. And others feel that we've simply are stuck in an endless cycle of breakdowns from which Western civilization never escapes. Despite the differences here, there's a kind of common thread with optimists and pessimists sharing something. Their philosophies of history, be they negative or positive, have caused them to look for some kind of a structure. They have looked for an anchor so that even in the midst of the downtimes, they can have some sort of confidence and hope. History provides the anchor, but please note that it's not an anchor dropped down from above. It's an anchor which they, people, themselves have forged. It is an anchor which people think provides some sort of stability or regularity, but it's really more an idol than an anchor. Maybe it's an albatross around the neck. Where are we today? Well, our society's been described in various ways. We are described as, listen to this, take a deep breath, post-capitalist, post-bourgeois, post-modern, post-collectivist, post-literary, post-civilized, post-traditionalist, post-historic, post-industrial, post-Puritan, post-Protestant, and even post-Christian. That It's out of one of Newhouse's books. The examples abound of present decline, but I think the way in which people, the euphoria wears off is seen, for example, in H.G. Wells. You know H.G. Wells? Or, you know, Wells? Not Orson Welles, but H.G. Although Orson is connected to H.G. because of that that Halloween episode. H.G. Wells, back in 1920, wrote a book. It's not a very good book, but it serves my purpose here. A thing called The Outlines of History, in which he exudes confidence and idealism. Things are just going great, and he can plot out civilization, and things are getting better. Having seen, however, how the world works, he tempered his view, and by 1933, he was advocating a kind of takeover by the intelligentsia with their superior vision, their talents to guide people, because he didn't trust the common folk to simply do things and improve things by themselves. There's a famous Wells quote that the history is more and more a race between education and catastrophe. One is either going to have to improve and get better, or things are going to go to hell in the handcart. It's a desperate situation, and yet there's still hope, Wells says, because of education. But you see, that's education which we operate on, for which we set the agenda, and from which we draw the benefit. By 1945, Wells wrote another book, which basically shows how low he had sunk. The title of the thing is called The Mind at the End of Its Tether, or we might say The Mind at the End of the Rope. More recently, Jimmy Carter, of cardigan sweater fame and fireside chats, Carter spoke of a national malaise, you remember that? People sneered and they laughed, and the reasons for that vary. Some people, of course, would blame Carter for part of the malaise. But leaving politics aside, I think one ingredient, at least, and an important ingredient in sort of sneering at that and poo-pooing that, is that people don't want to consider the possibility that we might be in a dismal situation, to admit it. You know, I mean, Jerry Brown didn't even get as far as Jimmy Carter. Brown came along with this cosmic vision theme for his campaign, you know, kind of space age campaign, and at the same time he's telling people to think small and do with less. And people never could quite make that mesh, and they didn't want to make that sacrifice. With the changing of the guard now, it's fashionable to be upbeat, to accent the positive. But in truth, there's a common thread to the negative malaise side and the positive side. Both the negative and the positive think that things are capable of being assessed and capable of being controlled. And eventually things will, not just may, but things will work out. A gloomy approach bemoans the present, but it points to what must be done to ensure change and to ensure survival. The positive side holds that we're already on that road and we're in command. As we look at our society, then, the vocabulary betrays certain value judgments which we make, consciously or unconsciously. For example, we speak of an idea, of a movement, being, well, what? You say an idea is, can you fill in the blank? When an idea comes, it's a biological image. An idea is born, you remember? Or think of that, an idea is born, it grows up, it matures, it decays, and finally when it's run its course, to finish the metaphor, an idea dies. Sure. All as if it has kind of a life there, an existence. Or we apply spatial terms. A society rises, it peaks, it declines, it falls. Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. And we make judgments there, in part because we're not simply satisfied to rehearse the facts, that would be very dull history, but because we also quite naturally want to see some sort of direction, or to use a fancier term, we'd like to have some sort of teleology, a telos, a purpose, a goal, an end. It's quite natural to look for structure, to look for this telos. It's not a new observation. People have seen that mankind's wanted to do this really almost all along. The ancient Greeks, Aristotle has his Organum. It's a body of writings that talk about how knowledge comes and how people acquire knowledge. Francis Bacon came along in the 1620 and wrote his Noum Organum, where he talked of an idol of the tribe. That is to say, the idol of humanity, that man basically wants to see some sort of pattern or structure in life. It's the natural thing to have because of man, because man is man. If you want an example from another source, maybe I would say a better source, you can look at Genesis. God provides structure in Eden, and even after the fall, after all is upset, mankind seeks still to impose structure, although it's a very warped structure. What happens? Well, after the fall, it's time to explain things, and suddenly it's the woman that thou gavest me, and she says it's the serpent, see? And suddenly we've got a little primitive flowchart here on who's responsible to what and what kind of structure is there in life. We naturally would prefer a positive teleology. Not too many people today are great, honest-to-goodness fans, of, let's say, of Nietzsche and his nihilism and his negativism. Although the truth is there's an awful lot of truth in Nietzsche when you look at bare bones natural man, just how man by himself apart from God is. If you want to see him in action, look at Nietzsche, and if you want to see him described, read Nietzsche. We have our own ideas, rather, of what's valuable, and we'll stake our family and our property and our lives, even, to attain that end. Such visions are really religious, not necessarily Christian, but they're religious, with religious elements. When we have such visions, we assume that we have some sort of relationship of knowledge and revelation. We have authority involved. We have a scheme of how various things hang together and have historically emerged. We have a worldview, a value system, an eschatology. Perhaps you get... Eric can't write that fast. Eric, you can always get the tape, see, from the library. You didn't think of that, did you? Well, but listen, they make great Christmas gifts, stocking stuffers.
Now he got his name on the
paper. That's right. Everyone will wonder who this Eric is. Perhaps the most militant and obvious example of a religion, or maybe a counter-religion, is Marxism. God is lacking here, but a God is not. That is, when one does not have God, capital G, one nevertheless has a God. Remember the large catechism says that God is that that thing to which man on which man hangs his heart. From a Christian perspective, the word is idol. Marxism's idol is only one particular manifestation of a larger, more generic sort of idol, namely the idol of history, the idol of time. Back to that again. Now, I have nothing against history. Certainly not. Luther liked history, too. In fact, let me lay a Luther quote on you here. Historians, he says, are the most useful people and the best teachers. We can never sufficiently honor, praise, or thank them enough. I take that along when I go ask for a pay raise. The problem comes, though, you see, when we start to make personifications, when we start to think spatially. An age is born, it dies. It rises, it falls. Those are judgments, but are they our judgments to make? Are we capable of making such judgments? The historian Arnold Toynbee once said that, Toynbee quote here, that the crucial questions confronting Western man are religious. Now, he doesn't mean that they deal with religion in formal terms, as in institutions or dogmas that are written down, but rather that the deciding questions, the judgments that are made, the value judgments are really religious judgments. The problem arises when in making the judgments we confuse creation with creator, and that's idolatry. See, all idolatry is basically natural or it's historical. Either it's a matter of the raw substance, we have a block of wood or stone and make it into an idol, or it's something which emerges out of history or out of our culture, if you will. If you understand culture as being anything that's not biologically inherited, anything that we somehow do or create. It's a rather broad definition, but it works. Anything which we then would fashion, some idea, some scheme, some philosophy of history, risks taking over, and we risk making that the standard by which the rest of history is judged. So we sort of create an idol and then bow down and worship the thing. Time is really a religious concept, not again necessarily a Christian concept, but there's a religious element to the notion of time. More than counting BC or AD, which it always gives me great pleasure to know that even Marxists and atheists have to count time that way. The existence or the passage of time depends again on the notion of a start, some sort of pattern, and we would hope or expect an end. How one looks at time says a great deal. Is time important or not? Does it run on cycles or does it run on a line? Ancient cultures, as you know, had it on a wheel, related to their idea of also of a kind of periodic cyclical redemption. So things will happen over and over again, a kind of repetition. What we think of time's passage, what we think of history and its movement, circle or line, says a great deal about our values and about our meaning in life. For a long time, Western society has reflected a Christian concept of history on a line, of time with a beginning moving toward an end. Beginning and end are not our notions when we talk, understanding that to have come from Christianity. They're rather God's notions. In the beginning, God creates. Beginning is his notion, not ours. Evening and the morning of the first day, that's his doing, not ours again. And the end, it's pointed to in the Gospels, for example, in Matthew 25. Again, that's his end, which time he determines that. But something has happened, because instead of seeing history in the passage of time, the fullness of time as God's theater, as his arena in which God has come to intersect man, or more precisely, the arena in which God has come to redeem man, I fear that history has become the vehicle for salvation or the means of grace itself. In other words, instead of the context in which something takes place, we generally in terms of Western civilization, run the risk of making history itself that thing which saves, that thing which offers us some sort of redemption or some sort of out. The idol of history glorifies, let's say, a particular time, past, present, or future, or it deifies a process, or some institution, or some group or class of people. And then life's meaning is found not because something comes into history and happens there, but because history itself has both the problems and the solutions. It's self-contained. Eventually things work out, sooner or later. History then becomes our solution, our salvation. How so? Well, I mean, after all, we do say you can't turn the clock back. Is it possible to undo something? So you don't have to turn the clock back. Actually, you can go forward and still find your solution. But before we get that far, let me say, turning the clock back implies that there is an advancement, that there's something here, that we're moving. Turn back and that we can't means there's no way of standing... of making time stand still, of calling a halt to this all. We're swept along. We submit to supposed inevitability. And when we do that, we refuse to believe that time can be challenged, that a situation can be challenged. We wind up almost kind of divinizing history, as if it is competent or omnipotent to simply carry on. We treat it as if it's an absolute, beyond touch, beyond any kind of alteration. Not necessarily our alteration, but any kind of alteration. Ancient peoples with their notion of cyclical time thought that way because they perceived that the clock, in fact, sort of did turn back. Well, it doesn't really go backwards, but it eventually comes around again, and you have the same kind of pattern. Things happen over and over again. They thought they could really do nothing to alter history, but that didn't bother them. I mean, it bothers them some, but it doesn't bother them ultimately because they know that sooner or later the wheel turns round again. They have a confidence that it's there. Today, with the phrase time marches on, you get the feeling as though you're going to be steamrolled, flattened there, and simply left behind. It's not going to come round again. Consider another point. The image of turning back the clock really is impious for both Christian and for one who worships at the idol of historicism. For the Christian, it betrays a kind of arrogant attitude. I know better how things ought to be arranged. We therefore stop and turn back the clock, and I'll make the decision on how things ought to be changed. Or it could display a fear or a lack of faith. Namely, we want the old ways. We're too timid. That way was comfortable. I could live with that. But please, not now, and certainly not the future. You know, don't press me into that. If you want a biblical image to consider again, you know, think of Israel and Sinai. Get across through the Red Sea. Here we are. We're out safe. And how long does it take until they say, "Oh, where we back at?" Say, turn back time. We know better. We shouldn't be out here in the wilderness. We should be back there, where we were better off in the flesh pots of Egypt. Or, don't make us wander any farther. You know, who knows what's going to be around the next bend? What's in store in the years to come? For the latter person who bows before the idol of history, the wish to turn the clock back runs counter to the assumption that things will work out. It's a sort of lack of faith for him, too. Although, see, the focus of the faith is different. His faith is in history. He's almost afraid that although he's made history his idol, it's maybe not quite as competent as he might think. Fierce confidence is often displayed in the inevitable flow of time. Sometimes this is frighteningly dehumanizing. Marxism with an inevitable victory. Note again the idols here with its various component parts. I mentioned before, you got the glorification of time. Remember, time has certain religious concepts. Glorification of time, in Marxism's case, it's the future. Deification of a process, socioeconomic evolution, institution. The state coming out of the industrial world, class of people, proletariat. In a slightly different vein, consider the confidence in time's inevitable salvation, on the other hand, by supply-side economics. Okay. Lest we make Marxism the whipping boy of the evening. Supply-side economics says that given certain situations, when we orchestrate certain things certain ways, this shall be the result. It's there on the Laffer curve. See, it's got to come about. Strange bedfellows, you know, to put Marxisms in with free market capitalists, but both of them really have an expression of faith, a trust that time will eventually bring them to the end that they are quite confident of, that they've posited out there, put out there. When people say that time marches on, it implies, first of all, that they know the direction, the end, the teleology. Stop and ask yourself, how can they know that? The irony is that in mapping out plans for the development and the improvement of society, when people say time marches on, and it makes it sound as though we're running out of time, they actually act as if they have all the time in the world. As if this time is somehow the widow's cruise that's never going to run out. Marxist schemes, Hegelian schemes, very naturally and quite matter-of-factly expect an end. But if you try and pin them down to a timetable, when they say time marches on, at what point can we expect that? Not just that it's coming, but when? Give us a time. Then they won't say. And there's a sort of inconsistency, because they talk of end, but they give us endless time to run through the maze of historical development to get to that end. So time, when we say time marches on, it really doesn't. It's always kind of there. According to the philosophy of Hegel or Marx as a derivative, certain things must happen, inevitably they shall happen, sooner or later they will happen, and suddenly the march of time becomes very hollow. It's like marching in one place. One would expect that we're on a limited timetable, on a kind of limited budget, but as we grope through life and take the blind alleys, we've got all the time in the world to back up and to go down the other path we perhaps should have taken. And so time becomes infinite, almost almighty. The position of those who insist on some great scheme of history which they've discovered in the past and can extrapolate into the future is not always particularly comforting. Either all that happens is always right and we're in a tightly determined flow, or we have all the time in the world to make the wrong turns and go through the maze, but then why talk of time and why talk of end? It's not very comforting either. You know, then we're really always kind of stuck in time in the same place. Either way, the creators of these kind of historical schemes act as if they're very profound, but I sometimes wonder. A boost to the ego is the current fashion of speaking of multi-causality in history. Now, I will plead guilty to that. I always look for more than one reason why things happen. If you leave out the ideologies, the ideologues, the Marxists, again, for example, who at bottom line have all history determined by some socioeconomic factor. Everything ultimately is reduced to that. If you leave them out, historians routinely today talk about multiple causes. Hardly ever do you find a person finding one thing and saying that is the reason why. Because you've got all sorts of people involved, even if you have one person involved. Why does Luther nail the 95 Theses on the church door? Well, I mean, there's a theological reason, but there's also a very practical social reason, too, in the way in which things were done in a university setting. Say, suddenly we've got two causes already. So multi-causality is sort of the way to go. And people look for causes. They like to find it. One of the most fascinating books I read, and it sparked the probably one of the better discussions I had once in a grad class, that was on French Revolution. We were reading all sorts of different explanations on why the revolution comes, this cause and that cause, and it's all there. One person wrote about all the bad things that were around in society at the time, but then concluded none of them really caused the revolution. It just happened. It was just a spontaneous thing that erupted. Class liked that one. I think we were fed up with looking for causes by that time. They liked that. It wasn't, Prof didn't particularly care for it. She still wanted multi-causality, but I can understand that now. When we get into multi-causality, though, we've got to be careful, because the term cause reveals some sort of a commitment. We speak of social causes, economic causes, political, geographic, intellectual. But such an identification, when we say this causes that and this feeds into that, we again assume as if we know where the telos is, where the end is, what the goal of this all is. Causes lead to products. Doesn't sound like very religious language, but it really, in a sense, is. Furthermore, as historians approach a given period, or they seek out causes, they act as if they're quite capable of finding them all. The first look at an item may not reveal it all, but if we're patient, if we shed enough light on it, if we give ourselves enough time, we'll come up with all the reasons why something happens, or at least all the reasonable reasons. I mean, there may be some tiny little thing lurking there that really doesn't amount to much. But we'll get it all. That's a terribly confident spirit. Moreover, this phrase that we now have the whole picture, that's really Hegelian. Everything is self-contained. Hegel's approach to history, whether it's adopted consciously or unconsciously today, assumes that for all the situations and all the problems, there is also within history an explanation. Everything is there within the confines of history. You need not look outside of that process that's going on. All the necessary building blocks are there for man to grasp, to understand. And there is then a kind of infallibility here. That if we look at this, we'll always wind up with a solution. It may take us some time, but we can do it. We can find the direction, the flow of history toward the future. And those very words, direction, flow, and future, again, we're back to the religious route, implying that we have an end. But how do we know that? Where does it come from? Well, history shows that, comes the reply. And there we are again. We're back to the idol. Okay? History does it for us. More sophisticated than a block of stone, maybe, carved out, but it's an idol nonetheless. This is very serious business. It's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to escape the jargon that we use today. It's as much a part of our working vocabulary, I suppose, as anything is. And I doubt if we really can change. Maybe I shouldn't say that. That sounds a little inevitable. That's a little bit of historicism there. It's maybe likely that we won't change. Is that sufficiently qualified there? But we basically have to use the language. There's not a whole lot we can do. What we can do, because there's no escaping it, is to at least realize that these terms are freighted, and realize what lies behind the terms. And to that end, you know, at least on first days of courses, not always, but quite often, I make a little speech about what we're after. You know, we sort of look for motivation, for causes, for reasons why, for connections, and then finish the speech by saying, but of course, that's our perspective. Okay? That's not God's direction of history that we're really analyzing, because that's a matter of faith, and that's something we sort of see a posteriori, after the fact. We're looking here really from on a different level. Some people champion historical pattern. Others despair of seeing any coherent pattern. There's a British bishop, a churchman one time, who said history is a pack of lies. You all know Henry Ford's line about history is bunk, which is not very sophisticated, but I suppose it's sincere. The Christian, on the other hand, has a scheme. Biblical history has a beginning and it has an end. And all that happens from beginning, with beginning, through end, is in God's control. For he's the one who gives the events and the time meaning. He creates all the component parts, the things, the people, the time in which they move. He's not simply a prime mover who sets off some sort of chain that runs on inertia. You know, who simply sort of hits the first domino, and then things go from there. But he declares a kind of constant involvement to the point of even being willing to redeem time. Rather than run to destruction, time now, despite all the things that go wrong within time, time runs to God's end. Not off to hell in a handcart again. The second coming is that end, where glory predominates, especially those who rise redeemed to enter into glory, which is very unlike the way anybody else views history. History no longer rules, God rules history. God is Lord of history. I'm reminded by the Large Catechism, remember, that to call Jesus Lord means, first of all, that he's Redeemer. There's not much point in being Lord over something that's not worth having. But he's redeemed it first, and because he is Redeemer, purchased it, therefore it is his, and he is entitled to be Lord of the thing, Lord also of history. God does not operate outside the facts of history. We see facts from Genesis 1 on. Even attacks on the text of Scripture realize that facts are important. They dispute them, but they at least understand that they're important. With facts, though, comes also interpretation. Namely God's. Events flow, that's the direction that God set. Events flow ultimately to effect salvation. And as they do, we have meaning, interpretation, result that again is his. So when we talk about salvation history, Heilsgeschichte, Heils refers to the Heiland, the salvation, the Savior. It's not just another scheme and another standpoint. Because unlike other systems and other schemes, the author here of this scheme stands outside history rather than simply as a creature bound or something or some element bound within history. All other approaches have all the supposedly necessary parts within the boundaries of time, including the thing worshipped. Not only the worshipper, but the worshipee. Can you use that? Is that a word? But here God stands outside that and chooses then to involve himself in it. So that events have a meaning because God sets the meaning, not us. The Christian view then provides really for the inexplicable factor. You know, no longer are we bound to find every cause. We may find what we think are all the causes, but then we also know that there is this other paratactic element outside where God touches history. And that's something finally that you can only grasp by faith. Now, isn't that just another sort of rationalization? See, other people cook up schemes. Is this not simply another? I think not, because others are operating really with a philosophy of history. History, Christianity, though, has no real philosophy of history. It rather deals with the theological side. People create philosophies. You know, philosophy is all fine and good, provided you understand that philosophy is how we happen to think things might be. It's a game we play in trying to find some outlook or structure. Theology, on the other hand, is how God looks at things. and chooses to speak and to address them. And that's really what Christian history has. It has theology. We do not sell ourselves on the system. It's not a system which we create, stand back, look at, eyeball, and say, yeah, that will work from observation. I think that that's safe. It is rather a matter, certainly, of interpretation, but it's an interpretation also that's given from the outside. It's out of our hands, and it reduces us to trust. You know, Luther's word fiducia, a clinging to. But then God convinces us of that perspective. It's something which also you can take a certain amount of confidence in, because when you realize what the scheme is and what the system is as it's set forth, it is so scandalous and so outrageous that no one in his right mind, and certainly fallen man in his fallen right mind, would never concoct such a thing anyway. The footnote, given the comfort and the confidence of the theology of history, then the Christian, I think, has to also guard against the kind of historicism. We may agree to, what I've said so far, but the danger then runs that we assume some sort of other inevitability. There's a temptation to assume that the promise of salvation guarantees then the moral victory of Christianity in this world while time still runs. That is not to say that God is not right and the morality is not right, but there's a difference between asserting that which is right and insisting that this shall conquer. There is a great temptation by some, as you well know, to extend the existence of God's moral standard with the assumption that this side of the parousia, the standards, are going to be victorious. You can see it as people try to Christianize economics, politics, government itself, other social factors, which other historical approaches also really deified. They're really trying to build a kind of kingdom that's not intended when we talk about kingdom of God. Now, having said that, that also doesn't absolve us from pursuing the Christian life, because God wants involvement. Even though we're in the post-Pentecost world, and therefore in the last times, we don't sit on the rooftops, but God expects and calls us to vocations, to work. So we sort of work, on the one hand, mindful at the same time that this may be the last thing we ever do. There's that, the Luther line about if I were, if I knew the world were to end tomorrow, I'd plant an apple tree today. Yeah, well, I'm going to explode a myth. Luther never said that. So don't do that. Don't tell your people that. You can say it's a tradition that Luther is alleged to have said it. There's a little book by a man named Martin Schloemann, Luther's Apfelbäumchen. Has a long subtitle about optimism and pessimism and something or other. But he's demonstrated that it's not an authentic quote. It's a romantic era quote that's sort of appended to Luther. The attitude is certainly there. There are all sorts of stuff around that you could reduce to that, but the thing itself is not authentic. Positive. Absolutely sure. No. Well, read Schloemann. You have to order it on interlibrary loan, though. So, Eric, when you go to pick up your copy of the tape, you can put in for Schloemann. Anyway, now what makes the difference, and why should we then, let's say, when we look at life and look at I lost my train of thought here. When we say that we're not guaranteed moral victory in this life, and yet we're still supposed to pursue this and stand up for that which God would have. What makes the difference? How do we know when to go and when not to go? And the answer is that you go back to the things that are standard, namely scriptures, and see what, in fact, they do promise about the triumph of Christianity or not, to what extent. And any kind of notion that we're going to have a grand, glorious golden age ought only be compared with some of these other passages about the end of time and the persecution that comes and that, were it not for foreshortening the years, even the elect would, And you get the image more of an angler who's there and pulls in one fish at a time instead of some modern boat that wades into the schools of fish and just gobbles them up like crazy, takes them all. In the end, we're not promised quantitatively a triumph, but we know that qualitatively God will bring things to an end and that he controls history. Well, that's all been, you know, sort of philosophical, although really it's theological too. But if you want something that sounds even more theological, consider for a moment some more familiar material here that revolves around time. We start at the beginning, namely, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. A good start. Because you have eaten of the tree, cursed and the cursed is the ground for your sake. In sorrow you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Time again, a fatal turn. There is also a positive side to this. You know, during the lifetime, in terms of simple preservation, we know that the time again flows as he wants. To everything there is a season and a time and a purpose under heaven, time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up. And we do things according to the time as it seems right, and God, as Ecclesiastes says, grants the increase. A bit more positive and in salvation terms, behold, the days are coming, time again, when I will raise up a righteous branch to David, from Jeremiah, coming, an Advent theme. All the messianic promises are bound to time, not yet, but wait, see, he comes. And there is a promise there of inevitability too, but it's not historicism, it's rather divine inevitability. Once the Messiah did come, then even then time doesn't stand still. A thing that sticks in my mind at least is this is the Mount of Transfiguration. They all go on the mountaintop and Peter says, it's good to be here. And the answer that comes back in effect is, yes, it's good to be here, but you can't stay here. See, time goes on. And you go from mountaintop back to the plain. It's necessary, not because history demands it, but because God demands it for the flow of salvation history. From mountaintop to plain, back to another mountaintop, or, you know, a little hill, actually not much of a mountain, outside a Jerusalem wall. In some respects, the second mountaintop experience is not nearly so spectacular to the human eye, but in the eye of God, it's extremely glorious, and to the eye of faith, it's a wonderful sight, where the sin of all time is compressed into part of a day, into hours of suffering, and in a moment, all time is suddenly redeemed. It is finished, see, and in a second, it's over with. It's funny how time works. There's movement forward to Second Advent as well, of that day and hour no man knows, not even the angels, but only my Father. So time is a mystery. Again, not something which historicism, which modern theories generally like. They want to know about everything. There are no dark corners. One more look at time in history, which we ought to take considering the timing here this season. And that is this, when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. And it happened in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And the taxing was first done when Cyrenius was governor of Syria, and all went to be taxed, every one to his own city. Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because it's of the house and lineage of David. Okay. Time again, history, facts, with a rather extraordinary interpretation. You know, where's the multi-causality? There. Yeah, it's there, sure. You know, because God doesn't operate without us, he operates through us. But there's the one cause, finally, that history can't account for. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for the inn. Time is finished. It's accomplished. Little details, rehearsal of yet another episode in the long stretch of time. But it's different, because here you have the Lord of time, the center point of history. People grapple with historical interpretation. They try to make sense of their lives and find out where they've been and where they're going. In so doing, we risk making an idol of time and an idol of history with our schemes. Better, I think, to bow before him who makes all time worthwhile and to spend a moment in worship and thanks For in truth, we have no philosophy of history. We really have a theology of history. Christianity doesn't have a philosophy. It's always got just the theology of history. Not because of what we do, but because of what Christ has done. Okay. Words, I think, worth keeping in mind at a blessed Christmas time, which I hope you all have. That's the end of my part. Now you get to speak if you wish. Eric can stop taking notes. Oh, good. You'll have to tell me what I said when I'm all there. Yeah, Dave.
Rising of nations, mm-hmm. falling of nations, mm-hmm. are all something that is external to him, and in that passage it seems almost, in a sense, irrelevant to him, because there's something that is beyond that and more significant than even the rising and falling of nations, of that kind of history there. But mm-hmm. it's the importance of a very simple history. While all of this universal history is going on, there's a very simple history that is almost hidden, that's almost a mysterious history. That is the significant history.
Sure. It's all over Christian thought. If you just stop and think about it a little bit. We are sort of within time, but I mean, in doing this, just for fun, I took just an English concordance and looked up the word time in the thing, or days, you know, or years, or things, time concepts, and they're all over the place, not just in counting time, you know, sort of so-and-so lived 930 years, but time where it really makes a difference in terms of prophecy and proclamation. Wait, you know, the time is coming. And yet beyond that, then you get God. You know, and we struggle with that too, trying to somehow with our language describe that. Now, I mean, obviously he conveys that to us and we deal with it, but there are all sorts of ways in which we use language to try and talk around that and give us a sense of what we mean, Alpha and Omega, you know, beginning and end. It'd be nice if you had letters beyond the letters to sort of get at and use those.
I've got one other question.
Yeah.
This deification of time that you were talking about, you applied mainly to more or less a teleological end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. I guess, towards mankind's looking ahead of him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, doesn't it also apply as mankind looks behind him?
From whence he's come?
Yes. And I see that especially in the development of the evolutionary theory, because there time is what creates. Given enough time,
mm-hmm.
this is going to,
oh sure,
you know, time and chance, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Marxist.
Yeah, it's there. There's no doubt about that. I guess I mostly picked on that because it's very easy when you start talking telos and time and direction and stuff. That's purely a faith statement. Yeah, you. Somebody said Marxist over here.
Yeah, in time they will have.
Yeah, see, there's a debate over whether Marx, when he describes the rise and fall of various points along his path of how things go, whether he's being descriptive or whether he's being prophetic. I mean, that's sort of in a small p sense. And of course, the committed Marxist wants to insist that it's descriptive, that this is absolutely identifiable. But I don't see how that can be, because once you get beyond where we are to the future, and he starts talking about how things are going to come about and be so insistent upon it, it's got to be prophetic. I mean, that's wishful thinking, if you will. It's a faith statement. It's a religious concept again, time in that sense. Hardly Christian, but religious nonetheless. Idol again, we're back to that image.
Well, from a practical standpoint, as future pastors, I think we'll see the personification of this concept of time and the idol of time when we try to change some things in a parish. They'll say, but we've always done it this way.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
Something that was...
Well, can I say something?
Oh,
in answer?
Please.
Yeah, even in a larger sense, too, I think to get people to think about that during the week, because, you know, they leave church on from Sunday, and who knows what kind of contact they've got during the week, and they're bombarded by all sorts of stuff on TV and from the radio and the newspapers where they talk about this shall, you know, economists predict what shall happen, even though, you know, they don't put economists in the end, and you still don't reach a conclusion, as the saying goes. But they're always bombarded by this, and people talk quite confidently. You know, they sneer at politicians at political times when they make the big promises, elect me and I'll do this and this and that'll happen. But everybody else does it all along too. It's just not quite that outrageous. But we act as if, again, we know. Now, people may argue over which direction it's going, but each person is convinced that he understands the flow. You know, and I don't mean to play the skeptic and say, well, we can't possibly know, and then retreat to the corner in fear and not do anything, because God doesn't want us to do that either. I mean, that's part of faith too, not knowing what's going to happen next, but confident that whatever's going to come. Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, keying off exactly what you were just saying there, that the Romans 8:28 about all things working together for good to them what love the Lord,
mm-hmm.
and are called according to his purpose.
Mm-hmm.
That by
his
faith.
His purpose.
Huh?
Yeah, his purpose.
Did I
no, that's
purpose?
Right. I just, his.
His
God.
Purpose, yeah. And that's a statement of faith, you know, a statement that came from faith, obviously. And those without that, keying off of that, the humanistic view of time, if you will,
mm-hmm.
there seems to be a lack of an acknowledgement of an end of time. And they... or they ignore it in their thinking, from what you were saying.
Yeah, it can happen. Yeah, on the one hand, they do talk about end as if they have a purpose or place to go, and on the other hand, in order to get there, they stretch it out and give themselves as much time. It's like the legislature, you know, that stops the clock at 1 minute before midnight so that they can get all the stuff done and pretend that they still have the time to do it. Well, people act as if they have the time.
And there's an ignoring of the possibility of the concept of an end.
Yeah.
Because of fear of the...
Yeah, sure.
Like
and what
confrontation?
Yeah,
of
and what happens when the end comes? Then what do we do? You know, I mean, the Marxist has his golden age. Maybe he's better off than some of the other, you know, some of the others who don't have at least thought that far. I don't mean to endorse that, but at least he's got a description of it. This paradise. Not everybody always has thought that far.
Yeah. Taking what Dave was saying too about the evolutionists having pushed time back to account for all creation possibilities, they do the same thing with the future.
Oh, sure they do.
To allow all those possibilities.
Evolution, you mean?
Well, both.
Yeah.
With the humanism looking for an end, not really finding one, having to keep pushing things out.
Yeah.
You know, next year isn't going to be better. Well, we better add 10 years to our plan to make sure it'll work out.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you... pointing back to Dave and the evolution, that made me think again. Stop and think once when you listen to evolution talk, the way they talk. It's survival of the fittest. Fittest is a value judgment again. This is fitter, or this is the fittest. You know, how do we know that that's the fittest?
Because we're here now.
Yeah, well,
we sure.
Yeah, well, that assumes we're fitter than something else, but, you know.
This died out.
Yeah.
Get into economic and political and all those.
You're sure this
aspects.
Develops and that's better than that, but maybe it's not.
We're better because we're more powerful than whatever.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, a student once who just you mentioned in jest. I think that I hope that he says maybe we should go backwards, devolution. Maybe we're unraveling rather than getting better. There are a few species that are smarter than we that checked out early.
With this kind of hope and expectation that, or I should say faith even more than hope, expectation that time is just going to keep on going, keep on getting even better, progressing. What do you think that the reality of the nuclear holocaust has done toward that kind of idealism? It seems to me that people without God have enough trouble with existential anxiety regarding themselves. Do you think that they're just not facing up to the existential anxiety of mankind? I mean, the hope that I have as a Christian is that history is in the control of God.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had the hope that history was in the control of man or of history, which ultimately goes back to man, boy, that would really cause me to despair.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think people without Christian faith, it scares the willies out of sometimes, because the end may come sooner and they'd rather have it come later.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you said, I don't know how you all feel about this, but there's some people who are very confident and they're sort of, well, I don't worry about nuclear war because total destruction can't happen, sort of thing, because God won't let it happen, this kind of thing. God has his plan for the end of time and it's not described, you know, this isn't part of it or that's not for it. I don't know if I'm quite willing to buy that. I mean, in the first place, I don't know if the destruction itself may be part of the whole plan.
I would agree with you there.
That may be stage one.
But I'm saying that as a Christian, at least, I see that something's beyond
that. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I understand that. Plus, also, maybe even if it's not the end of the plan, and maybe it's a way of wiping, how many people do we have on Earth? 4 billion? Let's say 4 billion.
Over
5 billion? Well, let's say we have 5 billion and 2 people on Earth. Maybe it's a way of wiping out 5 billion people and leaving 2 to struggle in a mess to try and rebuild. You know, that would be the end of me. I hate to think, you know, what odds or what problems they face, but I, you know, there's a certain responsibility, I think. You know, so I would certainly wouldn't want to treat this whole business cavalierly and say it doesn't matter how many weapons we build or what we do with them or what kind of brinksmanship we play. But on the other hand, you're quite right, too, that people who are frantic about it, as if we are responsible ultimately for our own destruction, that's not going to happen either. If it happens, it happens because God, in his wisdom, is going to let the thing happen. But again, we're back to, you know, he doesn't work without us, he works through us. So we're part of the equation here as well. Masks of God was Luther's term, larvae dei, remember? No?
Sorry.
Larvae is the singular, larvae ae is the plural, that he acts precisely through us. You know, and then we seek to do the best. You know, but life's all full of ragged edges, too. Ethics is not always a very neat business, and you sort of struggle to make the best and try and do what we think is the best. But that's kind of nice, because best, you know, the best judgment, that's a value judgment, best. But ultimately, what we think is best, all God asks for is the effort. He'll take that and use that one way or the other as he sees fit. And we try for equity or justice. Equity. Luther liked that word too. Do you know the story about Luther's, about the prince with Luther, trying to deal with the problems in life? So I tell that in class sometimes. About the prince and the two knights. Do you remember that one? Where they're... There's a good knight and an evil knight. The evil knight captures the good knight, throws him into prison, and the evil knight holds the good knight and refuses to let him go unless the wife of the good knight will come and commit adultery with the evil knight. And so she's allowed a visitor's pass or something and goes in and talks it over with her husband, and they decide the only possible hope he's got, terrible thing to do, but they'll do it. So she does it. At which point, the evil one kills the good one, returns the body, saying, in effect, bottom line is, I didn't tell you I'd return him alive, simply I'd return him. She goes to the king. Now, where the king's been throughout this all, I don't know, but she goes to the higher authority and complains to him bitterly what's happened. He hauls the evil knight into court and hears all the cases, and then commands that she should marry the evil knight, and she doesn't want to do it, but the king insists, and no sooner is the ceremony finished than he then pronounces judgment on the evil one, who's carted away and executed.
So she's made a widow twice, but then, you know, she wasn't real keen on the second marriage anyway. And the advantage is, the advantage is that she has not only her own husband's property, but she now will inherit the property of the other man as well. Some sort of compensation, the best he could do. And Luther says, there you've got an example of a man who has an impossible situation on his hands and tries to do something that at least seems equitable. He says, we go, you know, a ruler goes through life peeking through his fingers like this, sort of, you don't quite see everything, but you see as best you can and do the best you can, and then finally trust. So, but that's very different from people who are historicists and insist that we are competent to judge and to value and to set the pace. You had a question a long time ago.
Well, I had it kind of goes along with this. It's kind of a comment. It makes a lot to the statement, redeeming the time or making most of the time for the days are evil.
Mm-hmm.
It just brings that to a fuller light, especially in the concept of time.
Yeah, sure. And who redeems the time? Yeah. Now, sure, God redeems it, but we do it too, in a sense, by working, by doing that which He wills.
Do you have a question too? Are you allowed to ask questions or comment?
Well, your point about cyclical time, I think, can be well illustrated when we were in New Guinea, and remember when Myrna was working with the women's group to try to get those things done.
Yeah. This summer we spent in New Guinea teaching. There was a woman who taught at the seminary there and did sort of basic education stuff and music.
Australian.
Yeah, Australian lady. Because she could play the piano. And she was the liturgics person, their version of Professor Fremder, because she could play the piano. So she taught them the liturgy and got them to chant, if you can believe this. But she also taught a woman's class, and they were working on it was altar pyramids, I think it was.
For Christmas.
Yeah, for Christmas. And they are notorious about sort of taking their own time there. If you say something's going to start at 9 o'clock, they're going to show up at 9:30, and maybe people will wander in and get going, you know, an hour later, 2 hours later, or whatever. That's just the way they are, because they haven't grown up, you know, watching the clock like we've done it. It's just, they aren't used to it. It's not, I don't mean to make them sound as if they're foolish or anything, it's just not their culture. Christmas coming up, well, you've got to get at these pyramids. Well, yeah, sure, you know, and they work at them a little bit and work at them and then never got them done. And she said, she made the comment to them, isn't it a shame that we didn't, here comes Christmas and we didn't get the stuff done for the special church service. And one of the women looked at her and she said, there's Christmas next year. You know. sure. See, I mean, time eventually will come around. I suppose, yeah, and I suppose, you know, that's all right. In some respects, cyclical time serves us well, but yeah, as long as we don't, unfortunately, the class ends this quarter. Can't stretch it over. Did you have a question there, or are you just...
No, I was thinking because that cyclical time, though, is not, that's, seems it would be contrary to, you know, how Scripture certainly views time.
Yeah, from beginning to end,
And, yeah, particularly in light of the fact that, you know, picking up on your point, that there is a sense of urgency there, you know, throughout, particularly once Christ comes, you know, he just kind of gets railroaded through in 33 years and or whatever, and particularly in his ministry. You know, when you think of the number of years that God had to work with and how he limited it to 3 years and then that whole week and then in just a few hours, you know, like you were saying, that all of the sins of mankind and all of the time had been redeemed in just, you know, in just a matter of a few hours. It's pretty...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when in the case of New Guinea, it reflects their older culture.
Yeah,
they have cycles and things always happen and come and go. I mean, we are cyclical in a sense. Church year comes around and we do it over again. But then how else should we do it? You know, I mean, should we have one Christmas celebration and never celebrate it again? You know, I mean, what season would we be in?
But we don't know that it's going to come around again, though.
Yeah, we'd be in perpetual Pentecost, you know.
Holy green. Holy green.
Yeah, green all the time, you know. And I mean, you'd run out of introits and all sorts of things.
But even within that, we're looking more of a spiral.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
And this is Advent 1986, not Advent 1985 again.
Yeah, which is not to imply that we can sort of figure out how many more are to come,
oh.
or that you can expect, well, 2,000 is a reasonable time, or 3,000 or whatever, because the truth of the matter is once the promise of the Paraclete comes, and it comes, and then the church, he comes, and then he promises that the church should go from Jerusalem, you know, in Judea, Samaria, and uttermost parts of the earth. And once this, you know, Jewish mindset, the uttermost parts of the earth is, it's kind of like New York City. You know, the map, well, now they've got them for all the cities. Once you get across the Hudson, you're at the end of the world for people from Manhattan. And for the Jews, once they get outside their environment into the Gentile world, that's uttermost parts of the earth, in a sense. So this is it. See, I mean, this is... This is, in a sense, the last second. It's been the last second for nearly 2,000 years, which I guess is a real jolt as far as mission endeavors go. You know, we're sort of, in a sense, on borrowed time. Well, we're not. I mean, he gives us the time, but it seems like don't waste it.
Last day.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I think of this, it's kind of like going up the tower. The Carillon,
mm-hmm.
the tower, you can't really turn around, and you don't know where the end is, you just keep going.
Yeah, that's sort of it. You're not sure if the next step is or the...
Well, our numbering, we're counting up, we're not counting down.
It's yeah.
a difficult trip for some of us.
That's
too.
Interesting. good.
It's an interesting paradox. That, as you pointed out, there's a tendency to want to think that either we are in a good time now or that if things are bad, things will get better. That it's a bit of a paradox that things will be getting better where this is an attitude that we see, but at the same time we see the popularity of millennialism, which is showing or anticipating times to get worse.
Which is good. You know, I
that's
mean,
why they all live in Carolina.
Good in terms of necessary for the scheme. Yeah. Well, and you've seen plenty of sects too, how they figure out time. You know, maybe they Jehovah's Witnesses or whatever, counting down the scheme, or even ones that are, you know, ostensibly more Christian with the dispensationalist stuff. And we start counting time and figuring out when this is going to happen and that's going to happen. That's really kind of a historicism.
I had a follow-up comment to that, that it, as we work towards the end time, it's neat that the God that we have has given us, told us about the signs, you know, that he left with us, you know, not only of the sacraments, but in history,
mm-hmm.
you know, the earthquakes and the rumors of war and that sort of thing, that for the Christian, we can see these signs and see that God is still at work. These are historical events, but we can still see that God is at work. These are signs kind of towards Christians saying, hey, I'm still in control here, and these are things that I promised would come, and
mm-hmm.
it's all pointing still towards the end.
Yeah, they're really almost comforting in
yeah.
a sense. I mean, in and of themselves, they're disasters, but the fact that they occur, yeah, you're quite right. It's quite interesting, though, too, that you don't get any quantity about those things. You simply know that they're going to happen. It's not 2 earthquakes or 10 earthquakes or however many more. It's just,
mm-hmm.
there it is. Hey, John.
What I was looking at is, or thinking about, is the fact of the human lifespan. You know, most of us live here from the standpoint we know that there's a chance that we're going to be able to accomplish something. Or, you know, I'll be 30, by the time I'm 35, I'll be a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly you're at age 35 and you're still in debt. 45, you're still in debt. And suddenly at a point in time in your life, you realize, I'm not going to accomplish the goals I set out when I was 20. And there is that, like Carter was saying, you know, that malaise that an individual gets at in their own life. And I guess I noticed that as I worked with the elderly people that we had in the congregation, is that as that malaise began, it became more and more of a faith issue as you became older than as... that point in time that I want to accomplish anything in my own life, the accomplishment that they were looking for was that fulfillment when their time was over, and the time that they had with their Lord face to face was to begin.
Yeah. That's interesting how people talk. You think, you know, or maybe from our perspective, the people that get that way and they say, "Oh, I'm perfectly happy and willing to," and you say, "But yeah, that's right. That's, you know, find confidence you want, but gee, I mean, when time's up here, that's it, you're out of time." But then I suppose, you know, what difference does it,
yeah,
will that ultimately make?
Because it's like, what goals can I accomplish when I'm 90 years old? You know, I know that I'm not going to go out and get another job.
Yeah.
Now I'm not going to have the time to build up a, you know, a nest egg for when I retire or anything like that. The only thing that I really have to look forward to is that theological end of my life,
yeah,
and the final fulfillment,
yeah,
and the final goal.
Yeah.
And it's interesting in watching that, because as the older as these people would get, and in looking in a congregation, you see that whole span. And you talk to the older people that are 70 and 80 and on the doorstep of heaven, and they go through a period of time of about 5 to 10 years, if they have that time in this earth, of that depression. And then it's like, okay, I realize now that I've gone as far as I can. I don't have anything else to look forward to in life,
mm-hmm,
except the Lord coming.
Mm-hmm.
And then join. And with John, the end of Scripture saying, amen,
mm-hmm,
come on, Jesus.
Okay, it's neat to see people like, what you, I appreciate your thoughts and comments. I also like to see people like Nickel, is that his name?
Yeah.
Who's,
yeah,
83 years old.
Yeah,
I got a grandmother who just turned 90, who's very similar to him. She still lives out on the farm. And it's just, she's a good, strong Christian, Lutheran at that, and it's just really inspiring. They're still planting trees.
Yeah.
You need a lot of time when he's around too, Nickel.
Yeah.
Don't be in a hurry.
Another half hour.
Don't be in a hurry.
Because afterwards, he was still going a mile a minute,
oh,
talking,
yeah,
to
just,
people.
He's just, yeah.
Really,
I, once in California, he was at a district convention point. He was still in the Presidium, and they had a podium up on the stage, more like the lectern, although a little bit larger, but you weren't confined in it behind like that. And he got all excited about what he was doing. It was some, I even forgot what the image was. And he leaped out from behind there, and he's sort of acting it out as he's explaining, and so-and-so did this, and the angel did that, and he's playing its parts back and forth on the thing, and people never seen a guy for like that, preach like that, sort of run around. And yeah, he's an interesting guy, lively guy. There's one who spends his whole time, comes out of seminary and spends his whole time at one place. At Ebenezer, yeah, no, Jehovah Church in Chicago.
Interesting that Forhan was his vicar. He kind of, Forhan melted into the crowd after he said that.
Yeah.
Would have loved to have seen him chasing after those Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah.
But that, you know, I think that we are really blessed in the ministry and the fact that we do have goals. That, you know, there's never anything such as a retired minister.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a proclamation.
Yeah.
There's always the next person to,
yeah,
to hear the message. And a lot of us, you know, a lot of the elderly are not that way, because it eventually comes to a time when they can't go to work and do a particular job that they, and, you know, even with ourselves, that we eventually, our mental faculties will diminish to a
mm-hmm
point in time where some of us will have Dr. Nichols' mind at that age, and some of us will, you know, will be sitting in a nursing home.
Yeah.
And, but as,
yeah,
ministers, we have that ability that we have goals to continue to look forward,
mm-hmm,
to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with goals, even, you know, for lay people, anybody, goals, provided they always understand their provisional, you know. It's always
even the final draft, we think, is always a rough draft, so subject to revision. Carl.
This would be easy.
From the Wyoming delegation in the back.
Most I'm sitting in the west end of the building.
That's right.
Are all the fireside chats going to be from the historical department?
Have they been? No, they haven't been, have they?
No,
I thought Professor Nagel did one, didn't he?
I'm just following.
Oh, last year?
Nagel hasn't.
Who's done them this year?
Last year, wasn't it?
Four Hahn.
Hahn.
Last year it was. He did.
Yeah, he did.
I see. So this is the second?
Yeah.
No, I don't know if they are or not. We could monopolize them if you'd like, Carl. Take over them and.
It doesn't bother me. I was just curious what the method of the madness was.
No, I think it's just
it was
it's just accident that that's happened.
There is no method.
No, there's no great plot here or plan, I think, just
take
the way things.
Yeah,
the way things happen to Paul.
Actually, Professor Spicer is scheduled for January. He was scheduled for the 22nd, I believe, and we have to change that now because Dr. Merkin's Creative Church Management thing has been rescheduled to that night, so we don't know exactly what night.
Good, good. Are we out of time? I guess. Thank you for spending the time and coming.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it.